All right, hi everybody, and welcome to the final test preparation class in this academic year of History at Our House for the junior and senior high group. We are going to work through the test preparation sheets of the junior high class, and you'll have a test this weekend. And then, of course, we have a long weekend. And the way that we're going to ramp things up is that we're going to strive to integrate the experience that we've had this year in a final two sessions next week to bring it all together and to make sure that you have a nice solid grasp of the whole thing. And then we'll cap things off next Thursday with a final history through art class where I will reveal the secret symbol that I enjoy so much in the painting in question. And I think that will be just a wonderful way to just close things out for this academic year. So let's get to being in that position by working through the test preparation sheets as we can here. So let me share my screen with you and let's go ahead and work our way through these milestones. All right, so part one, of course, is write a brief description of the key event occurring at the date indicated and explain how it has shaped the America and or the world we live in today, right? So make a present-centric connection, you know, and in a way, it's your choice. In some cases, especially if we're looking at Menes Narmer or somebody like that, right? But primarily an America-centric and present-centric connection as well. All right, number one, 1914 to 1919. Timothy, go ahead.
World War I affected America's position in the world as Woodrow Wilson decided to enter the war, thus entering in America into the affairs of Europeans forever.
Okay, nicely done. Yeah, right. America enters World War I and becomes a world police power. There you go, right? Establishing the precedent, establishing the pattern, starting America on a new trajectory, on a new course. Okay, very good. I might also have put America saves Europe from itself in World War I. Might be another kind of outcome. I mean, it's really fascinating, and I don't think anywhere near as well acknowledged as it needs to be in perpetuity, that Europe owes its existence to the United States. It's, you know, we think of the United States as owing its existence to Europe, which is absolutely true. But they're in an interesting relationship historically, because the United States is the derivative civilization, but it is the dominant civilization now. And so it's kind of like a succession, or kind of like almost like a cultural dynastic succession. Europe was in charge for a while and then America takes over. And America has, very much, without exaggeration, saved Europe from itself basically three times, if you count the Cold War, which is the third time. So it's just unbelievable. And yet, the relationship between the two is such that Europeans are mostly resentful of and have all kinds of, negative views of the United States, which is kind of astounding. Okay, so number two, 1939 to 1945. What about that one, Bria? Go ahead.
America saves the world from Nazi Germany and the Empire of Japan in World War II.
Beautiful. Okay, right. And we could expand on that just a little bit, but I mean, I would give full marks for that, because basically it saves the world is no exaggeration. And then you could say, well, you could also talk about becoming more of a world police power than ever before, or something to that effect, right? Because World War II is everything in a way that World War I didn't quite turn out to be, in a number of regards. World War II finally, in a sense, solved the problem of Imperial Germany, right? And it's kind of remarkable how naively people, view war negatively and critically and say, well, war is not the answer. Well, sometimes war is the answer. And it certainly was the answer to the phenomenon of Nazism, for instance. Now, World War II, of course, in particular, eradicated Nazism. I mean, that is a phenomenal outcome for humanity. Other outcomes include America becoming a permanent police power of Europe. Although that pretty much happened with World War I. If we look at the record, America could not extract itself. It attempted to. And it's very interesting because there was an American president, Harding. I mentioned him because of the so-called return to normalcy. But Harding said something very interesting. He said, it was kind of Freudian, which means he said something that he didn't mean to say. He said, America does not mean to be entangled. This was a quote from him talking about how America would act. And he said, we do not mean to be entangled. And I thought that was really like a subconscious confession that he was saying, we don't want to be, but we are, and there's nothing we can do about it. He didn't say those words, of course. But after World War I, you can really see that America just does not know what to do. It's like a country that is adrift in a contest of ideas that it just doesn't know how to resolve. And World War II is kind of going to solve that in a sense as well. World War II is going to force America, which can't think terribly clearly on this issue anymore, to basically be the world police power despite itself. And from then on, it just can't seem to pull out. It becomes inextricably entangled in the affairs of the world. So, 1947, along those lines, who's next? Well, we had Bria and Timothy, so what about you, Cliff?
Well, 1947 was the Truman Doctrine, which pretty much said that our job as a country was to stop the spread of communism.
Okay. All right, so that's pretty much enough, right? The Truman Doctrine announces that the United States will police the world permanently against communism. And if you want to be a little bit more present-centric about it, because, I mean, does the United States have to do that today, Cliff?
No.
No, not really, because there's only two pitiful communist countries left. Strictly speaking, North Korea and Cuba, really. I mean, China is a very special case. And it's not, I wouldn't say that China is ideologically committed to communism anymore. In some ways, which would shock Americans, China is more free than America is. And this is just really quite strange. But that's another one of those subtleties of history. That American freedom is on the decline, whereas Chinese freedom, since about 1978, has been doing relatively well, which, of course, is a relative thing. So, 1947, what I wanted to say was, because, you know, America doesn't have to police the world against communism anymore. Nobody is crazy enough to be a communist anymore. And that would literally be the definition of your mental state if you really believed in communism. It is such a debilitating concept that it just ruins the societies that implement it. So, since, you know, America doesn't have to do that anymore, what is the present-centric outcome of 1947? Can anybody take that one on? We'll talk more about that next week in our integration. But what is the present-centric outcome of America's decision to police the world against communism? Who can answer that? So how do you answer that question? You take the past, the Truman Doctrine. You take the present. You take the past, you take the present, da 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 da. You guys are too young for that song. But anyway, it was from a TV show. So, how do you make the connection? King?
Alright, so, to connect to the present, not, you know, we're not involved in stopping communism from, you know, in all of Europe anymore, but we got into the Middle East, Turkey and Greece. Well, Greece isn't really the Middle East, but Turkey specifically, to connect to the Middle East, which
There you go. Exactly. That is the present-centric connection. The war on terror is the present-centric outcome of the Truman Doctrine. There is a thought that most people aren't capable of. Because, you know, you got to be able to summon that chain of causation between the past and present and realize that the attacks of 9/11 were substantially caused by the Truman Doctrine. Ha! Whoa, my gosh. Don't say that. That's too controversial. But it is the case because America's inability to kind of navigate through the issues of the Middle East in the Islamist entanglement is what has given rise to modern terrorism. And so it's not, I wouldn't say it's Truman's fault that the Twin Towers were destroyed, but I would say that his choices were an important cause of that outcome. And this is the way history works. It's not as if, you know, you have events that maybe 50 years apart or 200 or 2,000 years apart, but they impact each other. You can't disconnect past and present. I mean, you'd be crazy to suggest that the United States today, 2015, does not have something to do with the birth of Jesus, 4 BC. Right? So if you can see a 2,000-year connection, well, then what's preventing you from making a 50-year connection? I mean, that would be kind of nuts, right? So, I mean, that's the point here, is that we do need to be able to develop this ability to bridge the gap between the facts of the past and our experience in the present. And that's what we're looking for here in these descriptions. And this is the type of thinking that I want to encourage in you, because if you see the Truman Doctrine as just about communism, then it actually will not matter to you. It won't. Now, that's not your fault. It's historians' fault. It's entirely their fault. Because that's what they've done. They've convinced us that history is about the past. So you write down in your answer that the Truman Doctrine is about the containing of communism. Well, now you just killed that fact. There's no way you can make that important. The way to make it important is to find the connection between that and now. And one of them is the Middle Eastern entanglement created by the Truman Doctrine, which led to the war on terror. And terrorists shooting people or getting shot, thank goodness this time, in Texas a few days ago, right? And all of that, it's connected. There's a web of causation in history that interweaves everything. It's fascinating. It's a little bit daunting. But in a way, it's also kind of beautiful, and it's inspiring to know it and to embrace it and enjoy it if you can see it. That's my experience of it. It's a lot of fun, and it's very personally empowering. So that's a totally different experience of history than most people have. All right. That was a long one, but anyway, it was fun. 1861 to 65. That one comes right out. Bria?
Slavery is abolished in America because of the Civil War, leaving us with a free people's country. That's what I put.
Yeah, I like it. Exactly. Right? I mean, we have a post-slavery culture. Thank goodness. Okay, 3000 BC. Classic one. I haven't heard from Sophie yet. What about you?
Menes Narmer unifies Upper and Lower Egypt, which just is basically the start of everything in modern and older history. It affects everything.
Sure. It is our first, you know, well-validated historical event. And I would say that specifically, if you want to boost that answer a bit, Sophie, is specifically the really long follow-on effect here is the archetype of monarchy. Right? So we live in a world where monarchy by far has been the normal form of government under which human beings have lived, and starts back then. So to understand and appreciate American history and the wonderful, heroic quality of the founding, in particular, in the name of individual rights, you need to be able to summon 3000 BC to do that. And that helps. It does really make it amazing what America is, which it is. So let's continue. Good so far. Number six, what is a doctrine? What doctrine did America follow from 1823 to 1903, and why? All right, Cliff, go ahead.
A doctrine is an official statement of a nation's policy.
Keep going.
The Monroe Doctrine was followed from 1823 to 1903. And the Monroe Doctrine stated that the United States should really stay out of European affairs.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty good. I like your definition. It's an interesting one. I'm sure we had a brief in-class discussion about it, and I wanted to challenge you with this term, right? Because sometimes we are not careful enough to pay attention to the vocabulary terms we're using. I prefer, in a definition of doctrine, to say, a doctrine is a set of recommendations concerning government policy made by an American leader. And so, in other words, doesn't quite have the official force of a law. When you have, say, the Truman Doctrine or you have the Monroe Doctrine, the thing is, it acts more like a kind of set of moral concepts, which you make reference to in order to guide your life, but you don't necessarily follow them. The people who enact them, the people who follow them, don't necessarily consistently apply them or properly apply them, apply the letter of them or what have you, right? So I prefer the idea of it being a set of recommendations rather than strictly the concept of I forget how you put it, but it was kind of a little bit more, definitive. It's not really a definitive set of conduct, rules of conduct. It's more recommended. Okay. All right. Number seven. What were three reasons America became involved in the Spanish-American War? What was an unexpected result of this war? Timothy.
Wait.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The first line of text is really small. Three reasons that America became involved in the Spanish-American War was that, one, the Monroe Doctrine stated that Europe and America should stay separate, so people wanted to help Cuba rebel against Spain due to it being close to America. Two, Americans were upset at how Spain punished Cuban rebels by putting them in concentration camps. And three, Spain sunk an American battleship named the USS Maine that was to protect Cuba. An unexpected result of this war was that the U.S. expelled Spain from the Philippines.
Okay, and decided to become a police power protecting the Philippines. Okay, couple things there, apart from that last little one that needs tweaking, there are a couple other things that needed tweaking. One, you said that the Monroe Doctrine said that America and Europe should stay separate. No, it did not, and it also, you see, the part of why America got involved in the Spanish-American War is a misapplication of the Monroe Doctrine. So this is part of that, issue we were talking about earlier with Cliff's answer, is that it's a misapplication because the Monroe Doctrine said no more colonization. It did not say anything about the colonies that existed. And it said that we want to maintain as little political connection with Europe as possible. And, there wasn't any. Cuba is far enough away from America and there was no direct impact to America whatsoever, no real danger to the rights of Americans. The only danger came when Americans decided to put their own battleship right in the middle of things. So that's that strange outcome when you said that Spain sunk the USS Maine. Well, it wasn't sent there to protect Cuba. It was sent there as a show of force for America. in a way to protect Americans in Cuba and American interests in Cuba. And that was part of that confusion as this war kicks off, that Americans were kind of fuzzy in their understanding and in their thinking concerning this. And that is, as I mentioned recently in one of our lectures, that fuzziness, that lack of clarity in American thinking is very much a part of all of the entanglements that America has gotten involved in. The Founding Fathers were much clearer thinkers. That gave them just the clarity, which is, usually people think of clarity as being a good thing, right? As being something that you have to achieve. And I completely agree. The clarity they had in terms of their ability to stay out of other people's wars was very empowering and very positive for America. The murkiness of modern American thinking is all clouded with lots of non-essential issues that people are tangled up with in their thinking is a big reason why America is where it is today and having such difficulties in so many issues. Okay, so we got to be clear that the Monroe Doctrine did not say to get involved in this war. It was a misapplication. Okay, number 8. Who was the first president to say that America should be an international police power? What was his policy called? Finally, what was his reasoning for this apparent change of conduct? Everybody's afraid to raise their hand. Well, Sophie, give me what you got.
I actually have not completed my test prep for this test.
3 days. I only ask you to do 6 tests in the entire year, and I give you 3 days to do it. So that's pretty disappointing. Rhea.
I don't have the last part because I didn't get to it, but I do have the first part.
Well, okay. Give me what you got.
Harry Truman created the Truman Doctrine. Let's see if I can come up with something real quick for the last part.
Wait. If you're doing number 8, then you're off. No, let's stop right there. It's not the Truman Doctrine. International police power. Who said it? Who said it? Cliff, what do you got?
Roosevelt. In the Roosevelt Corollary.
Okay, which Roosevelt? There's 2 of them, so we gotta be careful. Teddy. Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to say that America should be an international police power. And this corruption of the Monroe Doctrine was known as the Roosevelt Corollary, where he pretended that, okay, to follow the Monroe Doctrine means to police other people. Wow, that was quite the little magician's act when it comes to the old bait and switch. All right, we'll call it Monroe, and then we'll do the opposite. So what was his reasoning? Well, that, you can't get that unless you're carefully, reading through the notes and thinking about it. So the reasoning was, well, Panama and Colombia are in trouble. If America doesn't deal with these things, then European powers will. And therefore, we'll get ourselves in a Monroe Doctrine conundrum there. So we should be a police power in order to follow the Monroe Doctrine. Now, quite frankly, that is a load of you know what. And he could easily, because in 1823, when James Monroe announced the Monroe Doctrine, the United States was far less powerful. And European powers were still shocked and shocked into paralysis by the Monroe Doctrine. And that's what allowed countries like Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and others to become independent. So it was an amazingly impactful doctrine made by a country which, by comparison to the European powers, was not very powerful at all. By the time you get to 1903, we know that America has kicked Spain's butt. America is a superpower now. And if America had said to Europe, you better keep out or else, you better believe they would have kept out. So that's all that needed to happen. If you want to do a Monroe corollary, Mr. Theodore Roosevelt, all you got to do is repeat what Monroe said, and you've got a bigger gun, so you better believe the Europeans are going to go along with it. So all he needed to do was to say to the European powers, stay out of Panama and Colombia. It's none of your business. It's also none of our business, so we're not going to get involved. Because, well, we know what we are, and we don't believe in getting entangled in the foreign policy, in the foreign affairs of other countries, and because we understand the Monroe Doctrine, we're not trying to pull one over on Americans here. So, that's what he should have said if he wanted a corollary. Instead, what he did was he made a very clever reversal of the policy. And this is very sad because a lot of interpreters of American history are rightly able to point to conduct like this as hypocritical. They are rightly able to summon examples of American conduct that is self-serving at the expense of others. And they can look at this and they can say, well, the real reason you're doing it is because you want the Panama Canal. So you're just a kind of neo-imperialist power. You don't really care about freedom. You don't really care about doing the right thing. You just want the canal. Or in the case of the Middle East, you just want the oil. So they look at America and they say, well, you say one thing and you do another. And that kind of opening for criticism and resentment is created by policies like this that are corruptions of the real meaning of what America stands for. So that's sad. As you can see, I am no fan of Theodore Roosevelt. I think that what he did was entirely wrong. I do not like him. And if I had a chisel and I was allowed to, I would take his face off of Mount Rushmore and leave only the three good ones. So I think he's terrible. So, Keen, go ahead.
So how important was the Panama Canal to the United States' ability to, military ability and ability to, unite the East and West Coasts? Would it have been, without the Panama Canal, would that have significantly impacted our ability to save Europe in World War One? Never mind World War Two and all the other.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the value of the Panama Canal is hard to deny. Now, there was a possibility of creating a canal in Nicaragua, which is still a possibility. And China's currently developing this concept of creating a canal in Nicaragua because there's another route available through there. And I think that America had enough industrial might to be able to function in terms of the railroads and so on, to be able to move its equipment and people, at least, across the continent. And, of course, you have the issue of whether or not you can get your navy, from one side to the other, if you need to. But America has multiple navies. They have Pacific navies and Atlantic navies, and they pretty much operate separately. And on the other hand, as far as trade is concerned, yes, shipping is the best way to do it. So yeah, you are perhaps accepting a suboptimal outcome, but what you're also accepting is you got to behave in a civilized manner with regard to other countries, presumably. If you recognize them and you accept them in the world, then you say to Colombia, well, okay, we don't like the way you're acting, and by the way, when you want something from us, you might not get it, let's see if we can make a deal here in a nice civilized way, rather than us putting a gun to your head and taking it from you. So, that's when I look at the way that it happened, I think that it's quite possible it would have taken longer for there to be, a Panama Canal. And, Colombia eventually would have come to its senses because it was economically probably a really interesting idea that could have worked. And maybe Nicaragua would have made one first or what have you. Could have gone very differently. But basically, America's conduct was really far short of what it should have been morally and in terms of proper foreign policy. And as far as World War I is concerned, well, I don't think America should have ever gotten involved in World War I. So I don't even, you know, want to go there because, yes, it did get involved, but I don't think it had any business getting involved. And I think Wilson is responsible for that. So Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson both go in a certain container in my head when it comes to what America has become. So that's the answer there. Anyway, that's just me expounding on my views. Let's go back to the number 9 now. What was Woodrow Wilson's initial reaction to World War I? Here's another interesting one. What new idea did he have to lead America into war anyways? Now, Bria, put your hand down unless you're answering this one. Uh-oh, the hand went down. All right, well, you guys did not nail... This is not a home run today here. Okay, Timothy, go ahead.
Okay, just so you know, this answer is kind of short, but I believe it has everything in it.
Okay.
Woodrow Wilson's view on World War I was it was the war to end all wars, and America should enter to make the world safe for democracy.
That is his later view, but that is not his initial view, see? So that's exactly what I was looking for. So watch the wording, because you can get, you know, into a problem if you're not careful with the wording. Woodrow Wilson's initial reaction to World War I was that it was, quote, a war that has nothing to do with us. That's not an exact quote, so I shouldn't put a quote around there. I forget the exact quote. Whose causes cannot touch us, which has nothing to do with us, and therefore we should stay out. And if, again, you recall, Woodrow Wilson was a two-term president, and the second term of his presidency, he was elected, and the slogan for his re-election was, he kept us out of war. Man, sometimes history is just delicious, isn't it? So the slogan for getting reelected was, the reason he was a two-term president was, he kept us out of war. That's what Americans wanted, and they rewarded him with a second presidency for doing it. And then somehow he gets America in the war anyway. And you cannot, for nobody, I mean, some people will say, oh, it's because of the submarines. Oh, some people, it's because of the Mexican thing. And that is another load of you know what. He wanted to change the way that America lives, to what it is, the very nature of the country. He wanted it to become more of a democracy, to make the world safe for democracy. It's a different country. Not the Republic of the Founding Fathers. And the key word democracy is what tells you where pretty much a president stands in terms of the issue. Presidents in the 19th century used the word republic. Presidents in the 20th century used the word democracy, mostly. Sometimes very, very infrequently. They might say republic, but it kind of gets lost in the clutter. So anyway, yeah, make the world safe for democracy was the new thing, not the initial. Okay, number 10, what is normalcy? Why did Americans want to return to normalcy after World War I? And how did they propose to continue with normalcy after the rise of Adolf Hitler's regime in Germany? Oh my gosh, how can you have normalcy? Bria? Is your dog's name Bria? Oh, that's a shame. Thank you, Bria, for trying anyway. Okay. What is normalcy? Normalcy means the normal way of doing things, which means in the American context, neutrality in that situation. Why did Americans want to, because normalcy now means interventionism. So back then it meant neutrality. Why did Americans want to return to normalcy? Because World War I was too damaging. It was too hurtful. The cost of adopting a Wilsonian policy was too harmful, too high, too great. So they wanted to go back. How did they propose to do that in the context of Hitler's Germany? Well, they passed the Neutrality Acts and tried to commit to maintaining a stance of neutrality towards Europe, which they did manage to do for 2 years until Japan attacked, of course. Okay. Here is more of a discussion question. Boy, we're running long here, but anyway. Number 11. What would likely have happened if the United States returned to normalcy after World War II? Well, here's an interesting what if, right? So give a kind of straightforward reasoning for your answer. How did this affect America's actions to follow? Now, that's weird. I think I misphrased something there. What would likely have happened? I guess I would say, how would this affect America's actions to follow? So, what would likely have happened? What's the obvious thing that likely would have happened if America said, all right, sayonara? That's actually Japanese. So I guess they would have said, auf Wiedersehen, to the Europeans anyway. What if America had said, see you later. We're going again. We saved you again. Goodbye. What would have happened? Nobody can predict? I think it's pretty obvious. Keen?
Well, are you talking about the present-centric? You're talking about right away? No,
right away, because present-centric is harder to do. It's more extended, more indirect. I mean directly. What would have happened? In the moment.
No Truman Doctrine?
Well, yes, okay, but that's kind of, again, what would not have happened. I mean, what would have happened? So if there was no Truman Doctrine, what would have happened?
We would not have policed Europe. We would have.
And what would have happened to Europe if we hadn't policed it?
The Soviet Union would spread.
Yes, absolutely.
Communism would spread.
Yeah, so we don't know to what extent. Okay, we don't know how far and how bad it would have been, but absolutely, Europe was supine. Europe was on its back. And many people in Europe, actually, at the time, would have welcomed communism. So that's one reason why there was a Truman Doctrine, was because there were Greek militants that wanted communism. You could find communist parties in pretty much every country in Europe. So Europe is socialist, and, well, communism is just a hop and a skip away from socialism. So, you know, communism, I think, would have succeeded in pretty much taking over Europe. I think that might be going too far, but at least most of it. And in all likelihood, the Soviet Union would have conquered Turkey and thus gained direct access to the Mediterranean, radically shifting the geopolitics of the world, basically. After that, you know, okay, then there's, you know, it's dominoes or, you know, it's kind of hard to predict where things would have gone. But I think it's quite safe to say that if the United States had returned to normalcy, that the Soviet Union would have taken over Europe. Europe would have gone to communism, which is staggering, which is the reason why I say America saved Europe 3 times, not just World War I, not just World War II, but also because of the Cold War. And it's just staggering. I think that would have been absolutely devastating. All of the history of communism is the history of a government that takes over and then conducts policies of mass murder against its own people. In China, the combined effects of what was known as the supposed Great Leap Forward and then the Cultural Revolution, the combined effects are probably on the order of about 70 to 80 million people murdered by their own government. And in the Soviet Union, the effects are similar, except the country's not quite as populous. I suspect the death toll is maybe 30 million people. In other words, literally, deliberately murdered by the communist government, or by policies enacted by that government that destroyed their lives. So, I mean, that is, you know, what would have happened to Europe if that was the framework of the entire society? What a shocking idea. How would the world be different? The Iron Curtain would basically be the Atlantic. And the whole world would kind of revolve around, Russian submarines in the Atlantic, not German submarines, and Russians preventing people from leaving Europe, and America trying to help them to become free and get to America. And wow, what a whole different place the world would have been. Now, in the end, communism cannot survive. It is a completely devastating system. So it would have collapsed. So who knows, what happens after that. It's pretty fascinating to think of, right? Because when I did that one map where it was like, okay, what would have happened if the Civil War hadn't happened? Well, if we try to make a map, what would have happened if America had returned to normalcy? It would be a pretty fascinating map as well. One reason is South America would have gone communist as well. And many parts of Africa and many parts of Asia would have gone communist. Because it was a time in history when communism had enough champions intellectually, even though it's wrong, which is pretty staggering, right? So it's so devastatingly wrong, and yet many people believe in it, and some still do, no matter how bad it is. So I think it would have been just awful for the world. King, go ahead.
Do you think that if communism had, if the United States had returned to normalcy, not policed Europe to stop the spread of communism, and it had been taken over by communism, Europe, that is, mm-hmm. and then once communism fell, do you think all of Europe would be kind of like Germany after Hitler fell and after Nazism fell, where they would all know how terrible it was and never, ever, ever want to do anything like it? No socialism, nothing like that.
That's a great question. And sadly, I don't think so. Sadly, I don't think so, because if you look, communism fell in Russia, and the reason why I don't think so is because if you look at Russia today, it's not such a great place by any stretch, right? So I don't see a reason why necessarily Europeans would have been much clearer in their thinking. Maybe there would have been a more of a clear distinction between different forms of statism, which means the government is in charge of every aspect of life, and communism is a kind, and fascism is a kind, and there's a lot of different kinds. Monarchy is another, right? And so if there had more clarity between statism and freedom in people's thinking because of a really vast imperial Cold War of the Soviet Union, maybe, but it's really hard to predict. I guess I do think so, yes. In a really significant way, I think America protected Europe from itself. And when you do that, I don't think that's ever good. I don't think that you should, in essence, I don't think you should protect people from themselves, generally. You gotta let them be who they are, be free to be who they are, and live the consequences. That's how people really learn. And so perhaps Europe would be in a better place today, if it had been conquered by communism. But I say perhaps. Perhaps. Because as you say, they might have learned their lesson and not be doing some of the crazy stuff they're doing right now. And some of it is just, oh my gosh, awful, unbelievable. The Greeks are just in a misery right now. So yeah, if you look at Greece, a very interesting example. Because Greece, America said in 1947, we're going to protect Greece from communism. Well, if you go to Greece right now, they may as well be communist. It's such a mess. And they are right now, 70 years later in Greece, most experts believe that the Greek government is going to seize all the assets of the entire country. So in the modern banking world, the government can digitally seize everybody's money. And that's called a bail-in. And it's already been done once in Cyprus. Everybody thinks that's what's going to... Well, not everybody. But I think that's what's going to happen in Greece, along with other terrible, terrible things. I mean, Greece is just a disaster right now. It's in an economic depression. So, what would be better? To have had that depression 70 years ago and be past it now? Or, to pretend like everything's okay for 70 years and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse, and now you're going to have a worse depression, and it'll take longer to sort it out, and people are much less able to figure out what's true and what's not. I mean, yeah, I think it's a real question. Which is worse? So, anyway, wow, this is cool test prep because it's just exciting to think about all the issues involved. But we need to blast through the actual questions for the sake of everybody that will have done them on the recordings or in any other time. So quickly, I'm going to answer the questions unless you guys raise your hands. So 12, who did America choose as a temporary ally in World War II? Why did this country become America's greatest enemy after the war? Well, chose as a temporary ally, Communist Russia, aka the Soviet Union. This country became America's greatest enemy because its political system was completely antithetical to Western freedom. Okay, aka you know, communism, in other words. Okay, 13, what doctrine was announced against America's new enemy? Why did this doctrine lead to a Cold War? Well, all right, Timothy's got this one. Go for it.
The doctrine that was announced was the Truman Doctrine. It said that America was going to be policing communism in Europe. The Soviet Union was not happy about this and prepared nuclear weapons for war. Both sides threatened each other, but they never fired, thus resulting in a Cold War.
Well said. Good. Good job. 14. Why did America support the formation of Israel in 1948? This next question is a little bit, could use some better wording. What did America's presence as a police power lead to in 1979, despite the great resentment of Israel's neighbors, of Israel's presence? I guess it's technically correct, but it is kind of clunky. Anyway, anybody have that one? Okay, America supported the formation of Israel in 1948. In order to support the Jewish people that had suffered religious persecution for all of history. And, of course, most recently, had suffered from the Holocaust. And so America's police presence brought about peace between Egypt and Israel in 1979, despite the great resentment of Israel by its neighbors. So this is one of those short-term and isolated kind of success stories of the peace process, so-called, or the policing process of America in the world. But of course, we know that 1979 is a dual milestone, a dual anchor in Islamic history, or in the history of the Islamic Middle East. The other one is what else happened. So 15, what is terrorism? What is the most important event of 1979 that made terrorism a tactic of choice against the United States? Timothy.
Terrorism is doing a violent action in order to scare and worry other people. The most important event that made terrorism a tactic of choice against the U.S. was when Iranian terrorists attacked the American embassy in Iran and held American hostages for 444 days. Jimmy Carter did not know what to do and did not attack. People saw that terrorism stunned the United States and could be used to prevent a war.
There you go. Or I wouldn't say it could be used to prevent a war. It could be used to paralyze the world's superpower. Right? So if you don't like to be policed, then all you got to do is be a terrorist. Because the world police power will not know what to do. So that's the key. Is the way that America has such difficulty in responding to terrorism because it's unconventional and because of these other issues involved in dealing with another culture, being entangled with another culture. And that's what 16 is about. What are the two main forms of Islamic culture today? What has America done to encourage the first and discourage the other? So that was the last set of notes that I published a couple days ago there on for week 34. And so the two main forms of Islamic culture are the relatively benign and private practice of Islam by people who are peaceful and tolerate other religions. The second form, however, is an Islam that is militant and that views the government as an agent of religion and of jihad, the spread of religion by force. And that form is called Islamism. So the United States is in this entanglement. It wants to encourage the peaceful kind and discourage the violent kind. So what has it done to try to do that? Well, the main thing is the war on terror is designed to try to do both. The idea is go to these countries, destroy anti-American governments, and help the people there to have democracy and religious freedom. And supposedly they will like it and they will cherish it and they will become, you know, more more worthy partners of the United States in the world order and spread the better ideas. Well, so that's the effort, the conquest and regime change of Afghanistan and Iraq. And both of those are on the verge of utter collapse. And the problem is that Iraq, you can't do it the way America tried to do it. Let's put it that way. It can't be done. You can't change a culture with in as short a time as America tried to do it. So there was a real naivete in terms of how do you really encourage the best and discourage the worst. What happened in Iraq was the worst just hunkered down and said, we'll wait until America leaves. And that's what they did. America said, oh, mission accomplished. We did everything. Oh, we got Saddam Hussein. We got Osama bin Laden. We're the best. Then we leave. And then what happens? ISIS. And then what happens? Iraq disintegrates. And because the culture, the underlying culture hasn't really been healed and repaired and encouraged to really embrace better values. And that's difficult to do. That's difficult. I mean, think about Europe's, you know, devastatingly long journey towards religious freedom. You've got the Reformation. You've got Martin Luther and people like John Calvin. And they would just as soon kill anybody that has a different belief. And so would the Anglicans. And so would the Catholics. And they're going to do that for about 150 years. That's all they can think to do. Is kill anybody that has a different belief. So, you know, the Europeans were stuck in the same mode. They didn't know how to embrace a better, more civilized way of life. It took them that long to hurt themselves so badly that they finally started to do things differently. And then with the example of America and religious freedom, that also helped. Because then you get the French Revolution, you get other changes in Europe, and it becomes more secular and okay, a little bit more free and definitely better now than it ever was in that regard. And Islam has to go through the same growth process. And it is fundamentally the same. But, of course, situation is different. The West has already done what it's done. America has already done what it's done. So the situation is different. But I think that inevitably, Islam will continue to experience a culture of violence for as far as the eye can see. I don't think there's currently, given what America's doing and how unclear Americans are in how to actually transmit better values, they don't know how to do it. Given that, I don't think we can expect that the war on terror will end anytime in your life. And sadly, that means it could go really much worse. It could trickle along. We could just muddle through, maybe, but I don't think so. I think other really terrible things happen, hopefully very infrequently and not too badly, and hopefully not everybody here gets drafted to go fight in some other country and all of those other things, which probably attend to larger war. But it's a trick. It's what I call the Islamist entanglement. It is so complicated. And that's what the founders wanted to save us from. That's what they understood with such crystal clarity, that when you get in these situations, you cannot see through them. You can't see through the muck and the muddle, and it's so hard to do. The only proper response is never to get involved in these. That saves you an enormous, massive world-altering scale of grief. Anyway, that's their view. Okay, bonus questions. That was Lusitania, even though question 17 is misphrased because it's not an American ship. And then 18, USS Maine. 19, Pearl Harbor. 20, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. All right, so there, we made it. Took us a while, but anyway, We got there. So, hopefully you did enough prep to benefit from it. And hopefully you will get a chance to do test 6. It'll be the last one. And you can enjoy your summer knowing how hard you've worked and you've earned it. So good luck with that. I'll be posting Test 6 later today. Last thoughts? Okay, folks.
Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.